Two men from different walks of life, both so curious, it drives them crazy. This is the Jack and Max Show.
Hi, friends. Today's guest is Anthony Uvinio. He was and is my best friend from childhood. We actually met when we were 6 or 7 years old in the first grade in Catholic school. And we became fast friends and just the salt of the earth of a human being. And we're glad to have Anthony here. After high school, and we ended up going to high school together, we went in different paths. And I am fascinated about the path that Anthony followed, how he's reached success in his business and his personal life, and most importantly, how he's committed to serving others. And a little bit of background on Anthony. He has a 30-year corporate insurance background as a producer on Long Island and has done extraordinarily well. And there's some reasons behind that we're going to talk about. But he found his calling, and he is a pastor at the Hope Reformed Baptist Church in Quorum, New York, which is a Long Island city. He founded two parachurch ministries, and he's a sought-after speaker at many conferences. He has participated on several debate stages with thought leaders on the topics of faith and morality. A real treat if you have an opportunity to watch some of his debates. What I admire most about Anthony, guys, is how he went from the corporate world to the ministry, his commitment to living a life of purpose and of service, because Anthony does not talk the talk. He actually walks it, and he lives it, and he integrates his faith into every aspect of his life. So with today's episode, we're going to talk about some of the moments and experiences that he has had that shaped his path, some of the aha moments that led him to become a pastor, and probably most importantly, some of the questions that Max and I are going to have with regard to life in general that Anthony could probably demystify for all of us. And in closing, guys, this episode is not just about religion or theology. Anthony's insights and his wisdom go a long way beyond that. And so get ready to get inspired, guys. You're going to get challenged and uplifted by Anthony's story. And Anthony, my friend, I'm thrilled that you're here, buddy.
Well, thank you and Max both for having me on. It's a real pleasure and a treat to be with you guys. Hopefully I can live up to that introduction. I really appreciate that.
100%, man. Very There's nice. No doubt about it.
And go.
And fail.
We're students.
Right off the bat. Let me get my failures out of the way, and we can only go up from there, right?
There's no failures in conversation, but I always like to say there that too. When I would walk into an audition to the casting director, I would say, let me do one really bad one first, and then we'll get to an okay one. And they would laugh and they would giggle. And truthfully, it's a way of saying, no pressure here. We're going to take the pressure off right now, you know?
I'm good.
We're going to have a conversation and really just learn a lot here. So Anthony, I think a good place to start is to give some context around your beginning. If you could just pinpoint one specific moment, something that was a major impact in your life that sparked your faith and actually set you on this path. Tell us about that.
Well, I think the biggest advantage that I had was growing up in a family where my mother and father loved each other and loved me and my brother. I think the building blocks of society is a strong family, and that comes through a strong marriage. My mom and dad, you know, had a great marriage. They loved each other. They were very vocal and visual in front of me and my brother. My father had no problem with affection with my mom, and he, you know, he made that known that she was the most important thing in his life. Then obviously me and my brother come onto the scene, and he models that for us. He models how to be a good husband and how to be a good dad. I was born in the Bronx, and we lived in the Bronx. Then when I was 5 years old, he wanted to move us out to Long Island to get just a different way of life, not to be in the city the way the Bronx was going. I wish it was back then when everybody lived on the same block. That being said, all of my relatives started to move out. So he moved us out to Long Island to be closer to my mom's mom. And he ended up working two jobs. He would work during the day at a business that him and my other uncles owned in the Bronx. And then he would stay by my grandfather's house, who lived in the Bronx, and then work the midnight shift at Chemical Bank in Manhattan. So I would literally say goodbye to my dad on Sunday night and not see him till Friday evening when he came home for about 4 or 5 years. And he did that to give me, my mom, and my brother a better life. So he sacrificed himself as far as working two jobs to keep us on Long Island. And it was in Long Island that he sent us to Catholic school, where I met Jack. And that was a good foundation for faith anyway, because, you know, they prayed, they talked about God, and they did stuff like that. So that was kind of my introduction to faith. And then, you know, me and Jack had a mutual friend in Father Joe. He was a big influence in our lives, just showing us that you could be a normal person and have a relationship with God at the same time. You didn't have to be a kook, you know, so much kooky stuff that goes on in religious circles, but you could be a normal person and have faith and love other people. And that's actually what I tried to do when I got into insurance. I didn't consider it a job. My mindset behind it was, if I can give somebody the same or better coverage than they have and lower their price, I'm helping people. I'm just here to help somebody get a better price on something that they need. They can't, you know, run a business without it. So I really looked at it like, not as a ministry, because I wasn't ministry minded at that point. But I looked at it as a way that I can actually help people do better in their own business. And that's the mindset I had going in. And it just happened to work. I had the type of personality. I could be out in the office making phone calls and meeting with people. And I was still not. I'm not a high-pressure guy. If it works for you, great. You make a great deal once, you make a good deal forever. Right? You Amen. Make that, you know, that great thing, and all of a sudden it's one-sided. But if you make a good deal and it works for both parties, it lasts.
So what I'm hearing is it all started with your parents. And by the way, guys, I know Anthony's parents, the oddest soul to the earth, and I love them both. Actually, I miss them, and we need to get together and break
yes,
some
we
bread.
Will.
But it's fascinating in business that you've taken that service-minded approach to your clients. And I know, because I've been in business a long time, as you know, that people want to do business with whom they know, they like, and they trust. And I think trust is probably the biggest underscore in that. But that's what you presented to your clients. They trusted you. They trusted your counsel, your advice. They knew that you had their back. And that's why you built as big of a business as you have. Is that accurate?
Yeah, nobody wants to be sold anything, right?
Yeah.
Once you start feeling that pressure, like they're pushing you in a direction as the customer, if you're resisting and you don't want that and they keep pushing, it's like, wait a second, it feels wrong. So I'm of the mindset that I want to do business with people who want to do business with me. Not that I've convinced them to do the business with me. I mean, there's a certain amount of convincing that goes on, because in certain cases, I'm teaching them about the policy they have, what coverage they need, what coverage they don't have. And again, if it's a situation where I can save the money, give them equal or better coverage than what they have, it's a non-issue. But there were many times where, maybe just because I was young in the business, that people didn't want to use my service. But that didn't deter me. I'm like, okay, so now's not the right time. Maybe a point in time in the future. And there was one particular client that I remember, after quoting his policies for about 5 years, in the sixth year, I quoted all his stuff, and I was better price, equal coverage. And he looked at me, he says, "Your persistence paid off. We're going with you." I'm like, wow, thank you. I appreciate that. So I didn't look at the misses, the times he didn't take the coverage, as wasted opportunity. I saw it as me building a relationship with him. And over the course of time, in the right time, he used me. And I had his stuff for about 10 years until he sold it. And in doing something like that and building the bridge, I actually made friends with a lot of my customers. A lot of my customers I consider good friends of mine. because I deal with them on a regular basis. They know they can call me. It's not like calling an insurance broker. It's like calling a friend. Hey, what do I do in this situation? How do I do this? What do I say? I had a claim. How do I, you know, posture myself? And that's what I do. I'm there to help them. I mean, there are times when it's stressful and the insurance market right now in New York is not good. And I have to bear the bad news of telling people that their rates are going up. But I also have access to so many different carriers that I tell them, look, this is the best price that the market is bearing right now. And because I have that relationship with them, they trust me and, you know, we move forward. So it's definitely based on trust. It's based on persistence. You know, I've been in the business for 34 years. Thankfully, I've had a good long run in what I'm doing.
Well, that whole persistence thing is something that all three of us share, especially with my work and Max being an entertainer and his auditions and the things that he does to put himself out there and land roles. And it does have that stick-to-itiveness, that persistence that's so required to make it work.
It's also relationships too. Just like you said, Anthony, I mean, you can count on a friend, right? True. I don't even like it when I'm in the store and the person comes over and says, can I help you? I'm like, what are you trying to sell me something? You know, I'm looking, if I find something nice, I might buy it. Leave me alone. Now, maybe that's extreme, but like, you know, you can count on a friend. So if you're helping, sincerely helping somebody with something, my friend is a car salesman. He says the same thing. He says, I'm not here to sell you anything. I'd love to help you find exactly what you want. And if you don't, that's totally fine. And he also has become friends with many of the people. They know they can count on him. They come back again and again. I mean, I'm sure your clients refer other people to you, right?
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. They do. And that's one of the things that I think is most important in a sales relationship, that the person that you're selling your goods to or services to, that they feel comfortable. If they feel comfortable, then it's ease of doing business. When they feel like they're on guard and they're trying to catch, what is he trying to sell me in addition to, how is he maneuvering to get more of my money? That's not a relationship that's gonna last. I don't want to be that guy who they feel like he's got a hook coming. I want them to know, look, if I have something that you like, I'm happy to sell it to you. If not, that's okay too. Maybe there's a point in time in the future. Maybe something's gonna happen with the market where things change and I have access to a market that your guy doesn't. I'm happy to help. When they're not on guard and they feel comfortable, that's when I'm comfortable. I don't want to be the guy who's trying to see a kink in the armor and say, oh, there's my in. I want to know the person. I want them to trust me. And I want to be able to trust them as well. Because there have been times I've sat across the table from somebody and I know that they're not telling me the truth. And rather than jeopardize my relationship with the insurance carrier, I just tell them, look, maybe now's not the right time for us.
And you don't call them out. You don't call them out, right? You just...
No, there's been a couple of instances where the person has been really deceitful and I caught them and say, hey, look, you just can't do this. You know, this isn't the right way to do business. If we're going to do business, I'm going to be honest with you. You need to be honest with me. Maybe now is not the right time.
Or I can't help you. I'd love to help you. But if you're not going to lay it out, I can't help you. And that's okay. Maybe not now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
And just to put a button on it, I do the same thing in my work when I'm working with potential clients. Sometimes I will just let them go. All love and respect. This is not the right place for you. It's not the right time for you. It's not about me. There's, you know, I'm detached from the outcome of everything that I do. And when you are detached from the outcome of everything you do, then that comes across as being authentic and true.
I think that for both of you, Anthony, I don't know you at all. I'm enjoying getting to know you, by the way.
Likewise.
But it sounds like that comes from before you're even a salesman. And maybe this is a segue, but that comes from who you are as a person. I like to hope that it does for me, but even outside of sales, being of service, Jack and I were talking just before you got on here of being of service to people. And like, that is a way of thinking, right? And that... Mm-hmm. goes into sales, sure, but it also lives far outside of it as well.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Look, I think when you go into the mindset of just trying to help other people, a lot of times, you know, people in religious circles talk about the Ten Commandments. You boil the Ten Commandments down to two. Jesus says, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. If you can recognize the transcendence of God and be grateful for the life that you have, and then treat other people the way God's treated you, I mean, that's the essence of life. If I can love my neighbor as myself and give myself over to them for their benefit, they're going to respond in kind. Not that I'm looking for that response, because sometimes that doesn't happen. But for my own integrity, I know if I can help somebody, that's gonna further this in the world, right?
I love that. You can boil them down to two commandments. Like, I treat my neighbor like myself. I'm not going to bang his wife, and I'm not going to kill him. So I'm going to treat him like myself. Like, I'd want to be treated.
Right. Absolutely. You're going to see people as image bearers of God. Each in the back, I don't know if you see that. That's a Kincaid painting, and I like his paintings. So when you're in a gallery, you can tell which paintings are Kincaid or not. Right? They're distinct. So when I recognize that God is the creator and He's the artist who's created every single person I come in contact with, and they each one of them bears the image of God on their soul. My goodness, I love the painter, therefore I'm going to love his creation. I've been blessed in so many different ways. How could I not bless other people who he's created in his image as well? So I approach it in the way, not just business-wise, just in life in general, that these are image bearers of God who are worthy of dignity and respect, and I want to treat them that way.
Love that. And you have that in your heart. It wasn't always there. You back in 2000, I think you had shared that was the time when you began attending church, and then the trajectory of your life and your finances were never the same. So can you take us back to that time and that journey and what got you to this
point? So I was growing up, my dad truly gave himself over to my success in the sense that he did two things for me. When I was going to school, even though he was by no means rich at all, he was middle class, lower middle class, but worked feverishly to help me. And he said, look, whatever you need for school, I will get it for you. Like, he was intent on whatever it was that I needed to succeed. He wanted to lay the foundation to make it happen for me. That was number one. And he brought me a lot of business because of his business in the Bronx. So he was committed to that. So I was driven to be successful. The number two factor in my life was I wanted a relationship. I wanted a marriage like my dad had. So as I was working and became successful, I moved out of my parents' house. I bought my own house. Things were going great. I really had a terrific life, except for the fact that I didn't have that one woman in my life that I wanted to marry that would complete the puzzle for me. So I was looking, and it just was not working out. Finally, I gave up. I'm like, this is just, maybe I'm going to die single. I don't know. So a buddy of mine that Jack knows set me up on a blind date, absolutely, completely blind date. And there's a whole story behind that. It's too long to go into. Make a long story short, the first night I meet her, I was incredibly pleasantly surprised. I saw her that one night, and that was it. From that moment on, I saw her every weekend. Now, on Saturdays, she would tell me, look, I go to church on Sunday. You know, you got to take me home early. And I'm like, oh, boy, here we go. So after dating her for a few months and seeing that this is a quality person who I would be interested in moving forward with, I said, let me go to the church that she's, you know, let me attend the church that she goes to. Now, it was different because, you know, I was used to the Roman Catholic type of situation. This was done in a junior high school at the auditorium, which was completely foreign to me. But it was a Christian church. So I went and the pastor would speak, and, you know, going to a couple of services in a row, he was really reading my mail. The things that he was saying from the pulpit were really hitting me. Now, again, Max, I'm from New York. So right away, the radar goes up. I'm like, she's feeding him information. This is how the cult works. I'm not getting sucked into this. There's no way. I'm from New York. You can't pull the wool over my eyes. This isn't going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So I pull her aside and I asked her, I said, are you telling him things about me? And she's like, no, I promise I'm not. I really don't. I don't talk to him like that. I'm okay. So after going to the to this particular church for a while, now my friends are also giving me flack because, oh, you're going to church because of the girl. And I'm like, well, initially, yes, but now things are changing. Like, God is doing something in my mind. Now he's reading me, you know, clearly without her feeding him information. So I got to the point where I recognized that although good as I was in and of myself from a good family, you know, there were certain things that did not line up with God's commandments. Love God and love neighbor. I lied. I stole. They used God's name in vain. And Jesus says, if you, the law says, thou shalt not murder. But I tell you, if you've ever had a prejudiced or hateful thought, you've committed murder in your heart. The law says, thou shalt not commit adultery. If you ever looked at a woman with lust, you've committed adultery in your heart.
So, I'm screwed then, my friend.
Yeah, we all are. That's the human condition. In the root of our heart, given an opportunity, a man will always proclaim his own righteousness, like I did. You ask me, am I a good person? Of course I'm a good person. I do good things. But deep down inside,
I'm from the Bronx. Of course.
I've done a couple bad things, but we won't talk about those. You know,
yeah. Nobody knows about them, so they didn't happen. Right. No, one guy on the podcast may know. I don't know.
So I recognize, based on God's law, God's standard, I failed miserably, and so has everyone. So I recognize that I needed a payment for my sins. And Jesus is the only one willing to love me to death and die on a cross in my place. So I said, wow, that's an incredible love story. And when you really analyze the biblical narrative, it's the greatest love story you would ever understand or know. It's unbelievable, where the Creator actually becomes your substitute and takes your place because of his love for you. So that resonated with me deeply. It took a little time. I was working out with a buddy of mine in another gym, and just out of the blue, I mentioned something to some guy who I didn't really know. I knew him in the gym. He's like, well, yeah, I know about that. You want to come to my house and we'll talk about it? And I'm like, yeah. I don't know why I said yes, but okay. So the next week I end up going to this guy's house. And I go into his basement, and it's him and another guy. And then all of a sudden, another guy, another guy, another guy, another guy. Now, again, I'm from the Bronx. I'm in the basement, and like six or seven guys are down there with me.
And you're old enough to defend yourself. And you're big enough to defend yourself.
One guy takes his shirt off, and I'm out of here.
Three or four guys, I can get out of the basement. I know. I will get out of the basement. Seven, eight guys, it's a little tougher. So now they
is this
they
AA? You're like, did I just walk into AA?
It was a weird situation. Knowing this guy now, I understand why he did that. He wanted me to hear all these guys. They're real guys who had an experience with God. God touched them in a special way, and he was just getting me to hear their stories. So they started talking to me one by one by one, and they asked me, "Well, you know, what about you?" I'm like, I'm a good guy. Like, okay, read Psalm 51. So now I don't even know where it is. I had a Bible with me. I didn't even know where. I'm flipping through. I finally find it. I start reading it. The guy goes, no, out loud. And I'm like, this is the cult initiation. At the end of this, they're going to try to rope me in. So now I'm reading the words on the page out loud, and another conversation is going on in the back of my mind. I'm like, first of all, I don't understand a word of what I'm reading right now. Nothing. What am I? And the second thing that's coming into my mind is, what am I going to say at the end of this thing to get me out of here? I cannot stay here. No, this is way too uncomfortable. So I get to the end of the line, the end of the psalm, and it says, and young bulls will be slaughtered on your altar. And what those guys didn't know was that I had statues of bulls, pictures of bulls. I was going to get a tattoo of a bull on my arm. I resonated with the bull. That was my horoscope. I was stubborn, obstinate, dependable. Everything that you could describe about that bull was me. And basically it was at that moment, because this was a psalm of repentance, at that moment, God cut my heart wide open and said, look, you could do it your way and be slaughtered, or you could do it my way and live. And I got emotional. I looked up at these guys. I'm like, well, what do I do? And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, well, the bull. What about the bull? They don't know me. This is the first time they met me. Right. So now I go to start explaining to them about how bulls are kind of like a big thing in my life. Their jaws are wide open. They're like, oh my goodness. So they kind of led me in a prayer, and I started to go to church. And that was the moment that things turned for me. Even my girlfriend at the time, she's, what happened? And I told her, and she said, oh my goodness, that's great. So God changed my heart. He pulled, biblically, he pulled out a heart of stone and inserted a heart of flesh that would beat for him. So that changed the trajectory of my life going forward. I started talking to my parents about God. It became real. Not that God wasn't real prior, but there was more of what could God do for me back then versus now. It's like, what can I do for God? What can I do to extend his kingdom and get people to understand the real message? Love God, love neighbor as yourself. That became real. And I started employing that because that's just what God's Spirit does. He compels you to follow his commandments. So
do you think that's where the journey starts for a lot of people, Anthony, where their first introduction to God and faith comes from a place of need, maybe a place mm-hmm. of desperation, a place of disconnection. Mm-hmm. And then once they understand what all of this means in their lives, and they switch the narrative, and now they start going out and serving others.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think every single one of us has a need. I mean, we're all dependent on someone or something else. There's no man is an island, right? So things changed. As I started to grow in my faith, I found the need to defend it. I knew coming out of a Catholic background, I would need to give an answer to the people who raised me, my mother and father, like what happened. And it wasn't too difficult because I would say I was a nominal Catholic. I really appreciated the upbringing in Catholic school and going to church and meeting the people that I knew and genuinely, wonderful people. This was just a change of the paradigm to recognize that I wasn't trying to work my way to heaven. I could never do that. Right? I could never be good enough. The moment you sin, this is the illustration I use. Once you drive a new car off the lot, you can never sell it as new. You could wax it as many times as you want and make it look, it's a used car. Once sin enters your life, you've sinned. You cannot be perfect, and nothing imperfect can get into heaven. The only way that can happen is if God renews you, changes you completely. The situation is so bad that God actually had to send his son from heaven to earth to rescue us. So that was the rescue mission, and Jesus seeks and saves the lost, which was me. So we all need something. We're all looking for something bigger than ourselves. That's what did it for me. So as I start now to, I recognize that I have to explain this to people in language they can understand. So I start to study. I start to learn. It's called apologetics. Learn how to defend the faith and explain it to others. And it was out of that I ended up starting with a buddy of mine, an organization called New York Apologetics, where we would go into high schools and colleges and teach them arguments for the existence of God and how to convey that to their family and friends. We think that this is a message important enough to do that. And that's how Jack had talked about the debate that I did at Long Island University so many years ago. And that went actually really well. That was the entree into getting into these other colleges and schools and churches and teaching them what we taught them.
It's an interesting topic. You've participated in several debates with atheists and people that don't mm-hmm. necessarily believe in mm-hmm. in God, in the Bible, and what is taught. But if you were to, in a New York minute, summarize the differences between faith and the existence of God versus someone who may not buy into that narrative, what would you say?
Okay, so I think deep down, everybody has a connection to God because you're created in his image. What the Bible says is people suppress that truth in unrighteousness. We love sin. We love enjoyment, pleasure, and all that kind of stuff more than we love God. However, when you look at the created order, I came up with an acronym, CODE, C-O-D, causation, order, design, ethics, and morality. Most scientists believe that the universe came into existence. The question is, what caused it? Now, either nothing caused it or something caused it. And if something caused it, it would have to have rationality, intentionality, and purpose behind it. If there was no rationality, intentionality, or purpose behind it, then we live in a purposeless universe going nowhere for no reason. Now, I don't think intuitively anyone believes that. We all look out at the world and say, something's wrong. The world is broken. Well, how do you know what broken is if you don't know what right and wrong is? You would need to recognize that we're going in a wrong direction, which means that we have a direction. But if the universe had no creator behind it, well, then it's just a random chance of event, and it could go anywhere, and there could be no right or wrong. It would be like a policeman stopping somebody on the Autobahn, which has no speed limit, and say, I'm going to ticket you for speeding. Yeah, but there's no speed limit. You can't ticket somebody for speeding if there's no speed limit. If there is no creator, and we're just evolved goo, a random collection of molecules governed by the laws of physics and chemistry, well, then whatever I do, I do. There is no guiding principle behind it. So when I look at the causation for the universe and recognize that it involves intentionality and rationality, you look at immaterial things like the laws of logic, moral laws. Moral laws and laws of logic require a lawgiver, right? In fact, another acronym I use is IOU, right? The laws of logic are immaterial, objective, and universal. The laws of morality are immaterial, objective, and universal. So every time you use the laws of logic, every time you use a moral law, you're issuing an IOU to God, because that's the only thing that can ground immaterial laws of logic and immaterial moral laws. So we all have an innate sense of God in our lives. There's a creator. When you look at the order of the universe, when you look at, there was this, the movie, this with Jodie Foster, I forget what the name of it was.
Contact,
thank you. And they got these big radio dishes, right, pointed towards outer space, looking and listening for intelligent life outside the planet. You see in the movie, she's listening, and all of a sudden there's a tapping, and it's a tapping out of the prime numbers. And instantly she recognizes, oh my goodness, that's not random. That's coming from an intelligent source outside of our universe. So if you would just take those dishes and point them inward into humanity, and you look at the DNA, there's more information in one strand of DNA than there is in 3,000 Encyclopedia Britannicas. In fact, if you stretched out the DNA in your body, it would reach from here to the moon and back six times. So that's a lot of information. Nobody looks at Bill Gates and says, looks at his operating system and says, well, that just happened randomly. Maybe with Vista, you could say that, but with his actual operating system, like that doesn't happen randomly. So the DNA is the software that runs on our bodies, which is the hardware. Think about this. Nobody would look at a computer and say that happened randomly. Yet you look at the mind and the hardware that created that computer and say that happened randomly, it doesn't jive with me. So you have creation, you have order, then there's design. There's intricate design programmed into the universe that, in fact, one amino acid, the statistical probability of that coming into existence on its own is 1 × 10^670, which is more than all of the known particles in the universe. And last is ethics and morality. If you recognize that there's right and wrong, and you recognize a moral law, there must be a moral lawgiver. Otherwise, morality becomes subjective. So you like butter pecan, Max likes Rocky Road, I like strawberry, which is right? It's a matter of preference. So when you apply that to certain moral things, moral issues in the world, let's say racism. Well, let's say I don't like a certain type of people and you do. Well, does that make me racist? No, not if morality is subjective. It's just a matter of preference. But I think racism is actually wrong. Objectively, there's a standard outside of us that we would look at to say, to measure our morality and say, is it in line with what's truly right or truly wrong? So if you don't have God, you take object morality out of the picture, and now anything goes. On top of that, in our Constitution, we say we hold these things to be self-evident, that all men are created with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, recently, there was someone on MSNBC who said, our rights don't come from God. And the question is, well, then where do our rights come from? Do they come from another human being? If another human being gives me rights, well, that other human being can take them away at will. Our rights do not come from other human beings. We're all human beings created in the image of God. Our rights come from God, and no one can violate, well, people do violate your rights, but no one can take away your rights. If there were a human creation given by other people, I want to know who are these other people and why are they the ones giving me my rights? Our rights come from God. The founders of this country recognize that. And it's very dangerous to think that rights come from other people. This is what happened in Nazi Germany. This is what happened in the 1700s, 1800s with slavery. Rights came from other people. You give human beings the ability to give rights to someone else, and that's a slippery slope. That's a problem. So I look at causation, order, design, ethics, and morality. That's a real quick way, and there's so many other ways to prove the existence of God. Without God, you have no object of morality. You have no object of truth.
Can I ask you a question, Anthony? As someone who absolutely questions the existence of God myself. Mm-hmm. I was raised mm-hmm. Jewish, just like you in Catholicism. I love mm-hmm. the culture. I still love the culture of my religion, and I love being a part of it. But sure. I absolutely question the existence of God. You said several times, created in the image of God. Do you feel that we are created literally in the image of God as the shape of us?
No, it's not a physical shape. Image of God means you have rationality, you know right from wrong, and you have community. So from all eternity is a unity in community and a community in unity. I hold to a triune God. So in order for God, the scripture says God is love. Love doesn't happen in a vacuum. You need another person in with you in order to love.
What right? about self-love? So,
well, what does that mean?
I mean, I struggle greatly sometimes with self-love, you know, the negative voices in our head and being able to love yourself and know that you are worthy of love, even if that's only from yourself.
Okay. So the question would be, do you hold to like an evolutionary type of existence? Like we evolved
more or less.
From...
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So it's going to be difficult for you to ground that, because what if you evolved in a way you didn't want to evolve? You had no choice in that matter.
Then I'd be where here would, in a different
right,
shape.
Where would your real value come from? If my great, 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 great grandfather was a monkey, well, and before that was a fish, what am I? I mean, I could be a good monkey. I could be a bad monkey. I don't know. What I think, Max, is that you're created in the image of God and you have inherent worth and value apart from evolution. Now, you can hold to evolution. I get it. This competing theories. I don't. I believe that every human being has a soul, which can't come about by evolution, can't come by purely mechanistic physical realities. There's an immaterial reality that I recognize. In fact, if you didn't have a soul, you couldn't actually reason. All you would be is a large chemical reaction responding to the stimuli around you. And Jack will remember this. When we were in grammar school, we used to do this experiment with baking soda and vinegar, like a volcano. You'd pour the baking soda
in.
Vinegar would fizz up because the vinegar and baking soda don't mix well, and that's the reaction. Well, if let's say you're a bottle of Coke and I'm a bottle of Mountain Dew, and we shake them both up and you open the cap, well, you fizz Coca-Cola, I fizz Mountain Dew. Which is right and which is wrong? Neither.
I would say you're just fizzing.
You're just reacting.
Yeah, they're neither is right or wrong. I would say neither is right or wrong.
Right, exactly. There is no right or wrong. So if we're just the products of our environment evolved in any way, shape, or form, there is no actual right or wrong. You fizz Coca-Cola, I fizz Mountain Dew. Again, it's subjective. I like to fizz Mountain Dew. You like to fizz Coca-Cola. But what happens when my Coca-Cola starts impeding on your Mountain Dew? Well, right. My Mountain Dew starts impeding on your Coca-Cola. You're going to say, well, that's not right. Says who? On evolution, only the strong survive. Survival of the fittest. If right. I want what you have, I come take it. As long as I can beat you up, who cares? I'm from the Bronx, remember?
What if I were to say that part of that evolution was realizing kindness and love over millions of years, you know, not thousands, but millions that we've developed into. And we know that there's like 50 billion planets in the universe that are capable of human life, of that have the right properties. What if I said over the millions of years, we evolved into people that not only physically look like this, but were able to mentally evolve to understand how to procreate. If every single organism in the world has the same I think it's three basic ingrained purposes: to live, to procreate, and to defend itself against, including amoebas, right? Mm-hmm. To defend itself against an outside cause, to procreate so the species continues, and to defend itself, and to find nourishment. That's the fourth one, to continue to live.
Sure.
Well, what if our brains developed too, you know, so that we could, in the most beautiful way, I mean.
Right. So what you're doing is you're importing a standard in and calling it beautiful, but we don't really have an objective standard of beautiful.
Fair enough.
From an evolution.
Fair enough.
Right. So
I'm trying not to be contradictory. I'm just.
No. That's
absolutely because I love
this.
I love
this
conversation.
For.
No, this is fine. And I'm happy to have the conversation, and we can agree to disagree.
Yeah, you're, sure.
Listen, I'm always going to treat you as a human being created in the image of God, worthy of dignity and respect, without question. What I would look to is procreation. Prior to human beings, how did cells procreate? They would split in half. It was asexual reproduction. That should be the method we do it today. The question I would have to ask you is, how did cells that would reproduce asexually now stop reproducing asexually, not only stop producing asexually, but develop sexual organs, okay, not knowing what the other sexual organ is that I would need in order to now procreate? So how did women develop their reproductive system and men develop their reproductive system without intentionality or rationality behind that? Do you know how difficult it would be for men to start creating sperm without even knowing that there's an egg somewhere, who knows where, right?
I think men started creating sperm long time ago with cavemen, having no idea there were eggs there.
Well, yeah, but how were they born? Asexually?
No. What if I were to say that was one way of our species controlling population subconsciously, knowing that if we were able to just split in half, you know, our planet would be overrun and so forth.
Well, yeah. I guess I would ask, how do you know that?
I don't know it. I'm just right. I'm purporting the idea that animals over time, of all kinds, developed that mechanism, literally mechanism, as part of their biology.
Well, yeah. If the goal is to procreate, think, and evolutionarily speaking, if the goal is to be self-sufficient, then I would continue to procreate asexually. To now procreate with and needing someone else, that's going to lower the chances of me procreating rather than raising them. So if the goal on an evolutionary standpoint is procreation, well, then I would be happy to just continue to divide and conquer asexually. Now, would I know that the world is going to be overpopulated? Maybe, maybe not. If I don't have a soul, what does it matter? Who cares? If the goal is to get my genes into the next generation, just keep dividing and dividing and dividing and have my cells multiply without having to need someone else. Now, I think God created man, God created humanity, male and female, and made them fit together because it's a reflection of his nature. If you read the scriptures, God says it's not good for man to be alone. Why? It doesn't reflect the nature of God, who was never alone. God was a unity in community. In fact, that helps solve the problem of the one and the many. So you have, I'm just trying to think of a situation. Oh, there's this video online where there's a father. He works in a train station, and he finds his son tied on the tracks, and there's a train coming that's going to hit his child. And he has the opportunity to switch the track so that the train avoids hitting his son, but then that train track is going to end up crashing and all the people are going to die. So the dilemma is, do I save my son and kill the people, or do I save, you know, the 40 or 50 people on the train and kill my son? How do you do that? That's the problem of the one and the many. Both are equally valuable, whether it's your son and or the people on the train, both are equally valuable. The only way that happens is in a metaphysic of a reality that has an issue of one and many. So God although he's one God, he's a community. He's Father, Son, and Spirit. On my view, anyway. That's the way I would see it.
So he tied to the train tracks? I mean, would sacrifice be an option to trade places with his son?
No. He's in the train station watching this take place. He doesn't have enough time to get down. And it's a real good dilemma. I mean, it really makes you start to think, wow, what would I do in that situation?
Abraham and Isaac, right?
Abraham is bringing his son up the mountain. He's having his son carry the wood, knowing that this is going to be the wood that he lays him on. And God tells him, okay, you're going to sacrifice your son. Now, Abraham goes ahead with it. He lifts the knife and God says, stop. Now I see that you actually trust me.
You were willing to sacrifice.
Say again?
You were willing to sacrifice.
Yes, right. So it's interesting that we're talking about this, because when God told Abraham to go, leave your country, he was asking him to sacrifice his past. But now God is telling Abraham to sacrifice his son, which would be the one who would be the heir through whom the blessing of the world would come. So in leaving his home, God was asking him to sacrifice his past. In asking him to sacrifice his son is asking him to sacrifice his future. And he stops him from doing it because he knows through Abraham the promises that there will become one who will bless all the nations of the earth, which I would see as Christ.
Yeah, well,
a lot God of theology. I didn't mean to get this heavy on you guys.
I asked the question.
So. I love it, Anthony. Love it,
okay, and good.
I completely agree. We can agree to disagree, and I don't even necessarily know. You know,
right?
I question. That's all I'm doing. Sure. I wouldn't even say I'm an atheist. I question these things as I think about them a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know sacrifice is a huge theme in the Bible. God knows in the New Testament, I was raised Jewish. I'm a little more Old Testament, but I know that Jesus made the greatest sacrifice of all, right? In the New Testament.
Sure. Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because these are things that I think we should question. We should always be willing to examine our own beliefs and test them, because if I pursue truth, that's going to lead me to wherever truth goes, right? And I want to make sure that I'm walking in the truth, because otherwise, if I'm not walking in the truth, I'm walking in a lie. I'm walking with something that doesn't comport with reality, and I want to make sure that I'm walking with the things that comport with reality. So it's good to question them, and I'm happy to further
something
that
I really struggle with. I really struggle with the ideas of heaven and hell.
Like, sure,
I can't imagine that when we die, we go to another place. I think that when we die, I'm a very spiritual person, but I'm not necessarily a very religious person. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's hard for me to believe that there's another place we go to after this world.
Oh, it's sure. Because human beings are interesting creatures. We want proof.
So the question that I would ask people in general is, what is your ultimate authority? What is the underlying base assumption that you have for knowledge? How do you know what you know? Now, from a Christian standpoint, I stand on the word of God. Now, it's important that when you're looking at this, that you compare worldviews. So my worldview includes God exists, a scripture is his word, and it's demonstrated to me through my reading of it and my living it out. When I look at, let's say, an atheist, somebody who doesn't believe in God, my question would be, is what's your ultimate authority?
And I would say, I don't know if I have one. I would say I'm jealous of those people that are able to have faith and trust that when they die, they go someplace, because I don't believe that. And knowing that, I think gives a certain freedom to be able to trust that death is not the end.
Let me ask you a question, if you're okay with it.
I'm completely open.
Okay. So you're jealous that I have faith that there's a place, but don't you realize that you have faith also that there's no place? That's still faith, right?
Well, yeah, a belief, yeah.
Right. Well, faith, right? Belief, faith. You're betting your life on the fact that nothing happens after you die.
Well, that's what I think. Yeah,
right.
I think
so. It's a faith. It's a faith commitment.
I think we turn off. Yeah,
right. The way you would ask me, how would I know? I would ask you, how do you know that?
I don't know.
Okay.
And I, that's right. What I would say is I'm more of a questioner then. I will be the first one to tell you, Anthony, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know so much. I am constantly trying to learn. I want to learn as much as I can from every angle so that I can come up with my own belief.
Max, so it's kind of interesting because where does faith come from? It's this belief that tomorrow the sun is going to shine. It's this belief that if I keep persevering and putting my auditions in front of people, that somebody's going to recognize me and I'm going to be on the next Netflix show. Where does faith come from?
But that, well, faith and hope alone is not a strategy because I could, trust me, it's a numbers game, Jack. Two years ago, I had 100 auditions in a year. I booked one of them. And I don't think that has anything to do with the quality of my work because so many things are out of my control in that.
But you kept doing it. You kept doing it. Why?
Because I love a belief. Because I love to do it.
And also a belief in yourself, your capabilities, and a belief that somebody's going to recognize you and say, Max, I love you. Right? So all I'm doing is making a correlation between if we have the ability to have faith in ourselves and a potential outcome, then we also have the potential to have faith in other areas of our lives as well.
So sure. Max is a magician, right? And
yeah.
I think this illustration will help, right? So, you know, the age old, the magician pulls the rabbit out of the hat, right? You know, shows you the hat, there's no rabbit in it. You stick your hand and all of a sudden you pull out a rabbit. So when we look at the universe, right, and we look at the scientific models that, you know, point the scientists to a big bang, right? They said all of a sudden there's this point of singularity and then boom, everything is, you know, expanded out. I called it an explosion. They don't like that. It expanded out. So the universe coming into existence out of nothing would be like a magician bringing a rabbit out of a hat, except that there is no magician, there is no rabbit, and there is no hat.
Isn't it possible that a bunch of chemicals in space collided with each other and
there's no space. Exploded? That's the problem. Time, space, and matter are correlative. This is Einstein's theory. Theory of relativity. Time, space, and matter are correlative. You can't have space without time or matter. You can't have matter without time or space. You can't have time without space or matter. Those three things are contingent on one another. So when Einstein did his calculations, he saw that as he went backwards, we get to a point where nothing would exist. So you know what the great Einstein did? He divided by zero. Which we learned in Catholic school, you're not supposed to do. You can't do that mathematically. So when that was brought up to him, he recognized, wait a second, my calculation is wrong. I can't divide by zero. And that brought him back to the fact that there was, they call it a point of singularity, at in which time, space, and matter came into existence. The other thing I would point you to, Max, is again, from a scientific point of view, there's something called abiogenesis, which means life from non-life. We've never observed life coming from non-life anywhere.
Sure.
Life
that sounds always, impossible.
Right? Life always comes from other life.
Energy doesn't end, it transfers.
Right. So where does the initial energy come from to bring about life, the soul?
I think that the universe has always been here.
So that's called steady state theory, that the universe has always been here. But that's going to suffer scientifically from the principle of entropy. In other words, things always get worse over time. They decompose rather than compose. If you leave your shed in the backyard over the course of time, rain or grass, everything, it's going to grow.
Sure.
So you're going to lose energy over time. If the universe is infinite, it has no beginning, it's always been here, we would have run out of energy an infinity of go. It would not still be here.
Even though it's so big, we can't even see the end of it?
Well, yeah, but the question is, where does the energy come from in order to make it that big and continue to supposedly expand it? I don't necessarily think that scientists say the universe is expanding. They just came out with the JW telescope, which is now showing it's contradicting the Big Bang models in the sense that there's fully formed universes further out the universes are supposed to form quickly in the initial Big Bang and then less as it goes out.
As they
expand,
with
this new JW telescope, they're seeing fully formed universes further out than they ever thought possible. And this would contradict the theory of Big Bang theory.
How would it, I believe you, but how would it contradict it? And I'm asking because, this as someone who literally doesn't know and is
that's okay. And I don't want anybody in your audience to think that I'm purporting to be a scientist. I'm not. I look
also,
at these things.
Me neither.
Okay. I'm just trying to think of a way to explain it. The initial expansion of the universe, the things closest to the expansion, okay, that are pushed further away would be less developed than the things that are closer in the middle, according to scientists. What they're seeing now is as they get further out, call it the edge of the universe, as they get further out, they're seeing fully formed universes out there. Which,
so multiple universes.
Right. And multiple universes. And they're saying a universe takes a lot of time to develop. Their initial understanding of how much time we have is now thrown off because they're saying, wait a second, this fully formed universe is way out here. It can't be this. Right. So the scientific method is always based on repeatability, right, and testing and hypothesis. The problem is with the Big Bang, there is no repeatability. There's no testing the hypothesis, right? You can't duplicate a Big Bang, right? They tried to do it with the collider in
with the
Germany.
Large Hadron Collider, right? I was going to ask what do you think about that?
Well, it looks designed. they designed the collider and they designed these things to hit each other, and they still haven't come up with a Big Bang. But what that tells me is, in order to get that, you need a lot of human manpower and brain power to design something to get to that point, which to me just lays more credibility to the initial designer, the creator who created everything. You look at the intricacies of a human being, just the DNA. Their structure. There's something called, and I talked about this last night actually with some people. It's something called irreducible complexity. So if I was to take one part of your body and remove it, you probably wouldn't be one of the major parts of your body. So if I pulled your heart out, would you be able to live?
No, I'd be shit out of luck.
Right. If I pulled your liver out, would you be able to live?
Not until I got another one. No.
Right. If I pulled your brain out, would you be able to live?
No, that would suck. Please don't do that.
No, you'd be able to run for office in our government.
Yeah,
but you
that's correct.
To.
There you go.
Right. So you pull any one of these organs out, the rest of the body's not going to function. So the question is, how did all of these things evolve on their own simultaneously and then get put together to form the body?
In a perfect way.
Of course, it has to be in a perfect way. One tiny cell on its own is going to die on my counter, no less in the wild. So all these things would have to not only evolve on their own, but end up working together in a system that it just defies credulity to think that it happened by random chance.
Even like, with animals? I mean, you know, animals survive because they have the same organs.
Yeah, but if you were to pull a brain, a heart, a liver out of an animal, they're going to die as well.
Right. And we do it a lot because they're delicious.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Yes, they are. That ends up being food for us.
Right.
Right.
I'm in awe of this conversation and just letting it sink into my psyche, into my own heart. My brain is processing what you are saying, and it's evoking emotions in me. Where do those emotions come from? Where is this feeling that I'm getting at the pit of my stomach as we start talking about this? Because we're all trying to make sense of it. Where this all came from and how we all got here. Spaceship, yeah. Yeah,
that's
aliens.
That's a bona fide scientific theory. It's called panspermia. Many seeds that aliens came, planted many seeds on the earth, and they grew up to be us. Now, the funny thing is, I think it takes a lot more faith to believe something like that than what we have. And it just kicks the can down the road. Well, who created the aliens? Where did their intelligence come from?
Another god?
Yeah.
Another alien god? Perhaps?
Or are they god in that scenario? I don't know.
Like, right. I think when it's important to define the... Say again?
Are they the devil?
It could be fallen angels too. Sure. To define God, God is the greatest conceivable being, or a maximally great being. Max, there you go. A maximally great being, right? So if God exists, it would be one God, because if there was competing gods, well, then he's not the maximally great being, right? Mm-hmm. And the question would be, well, who made these other gods?
I feel like I find God in all sorts of places, in nature, in the sky, in love, in all of these places. I think I don't feel God as an omniscient being so much as I feel God everywhere I go, so to speak. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know why?
Why?
You live in his world.
Damn, Anthony.
Most people, and Max, don't take this the wrong way. As human beings, we're surrounded with flesh, and our flesh likes pleasure. We like entertainment. We like the sinful things in the world. It was only until God changed my heart, changed my desire, that I recognized, oh my goodness, I was pursuing things that would eventually lead me to death, right? Those are the things that are not love for God and love for neighbor. If I love God, I'm going to love his creation, and I'm not going to do things to other people's wives that I do to my wife, right? I'm to love my wife like Christ loved the church. There's a special, specific kind of love that I have for my wife within the bounds of marriage that I cannot have for someone else. Now, you see the divorce rate in the United States and worldwide, it's over 50%. Why? Because we're not content with just one woman, right? Men have this desire to sleep with lots of different women. Now, the question is that okay? In a world without God, do whatever you want. It's evolution.
I don't think that's the only reason people get divorced, though, right?
No. Certainly not. But why can't two people get along? I love these guys talk about having world peace, yet they can't stay married for more than 7 weeks in a row. You come out and lecture the world or our country about world peace, how this country should get along with this country, yet you can't stay married for more than a year. One person can't stay married to another person for more than a year, yet you're upset that one country can't get along with another country. You know how difficult that is?
I find that sometimes as a married man, you know, I find sometimes we are all raised differently, right? Nature versus mm-hmm. nurture. And it can be very difficult to see the same exact thing as your loved one, you know? And I find that maybe a lot of people get married, and what do they say? Every 7 years, every cell in our body is completely changed and different.
Yes.
You know, we change as people, and I find that things become different in importance to us. Now, I'm happily married, but yes. That doesn't mean I've never had an argument with my wife. You know, right. Yes. All of
yeah.
us. Right.
Yeah, of course.
I hate using absolutes. I think it's absurd. I'm just trying to say, I think there's lots of reasons that people might get divorced because they realize they're just not happy with the person that, or their situation, you know?
Well, right. And I'm sure Anthony would argue, is it the job of the partner or spouse to make us happy, right? And to fill our cup? And the answer is clearly no. Anthony,
no. You could.
Right. So yeah. This is good. I'm glad that you brought that up, because one of my questions earlier was, okay, what's one of your base assumptions? If one of your base assumptions about life and the goal of your life is to be happy, you're going to set yourself up for failure, right? Because what makes you happy depends on what's happening. If I'm in a situation that's not good and I'm basing what's going on around me to gauge my feeling about it, well, happiness is gonna come in. It's going to go out. My wife is having a bad day. Well, then I'm not happy. My kids are having a bad day, then I'm not happy, right? So my happiness is tied to what's going on around me. Whereas the Bible talks about joy. There's an internal joy that you have that does not depend on what's happening around you. So that Paul, when he was in prison, could write a letter to the Philippians and write a letter to the Ephesians and still be full of joy, even though he's in prison. He says, I've been placed here for the advancement of the gospel. So joy is different than happiness. And if you make your life about the joy, the internal peace that you could have while you're in the midst of chaos, that's where the real value comes in. Like you said earlier, sacrifice is an incredible virtue. When I see my wife having a bad day, rather than letting that affect me negatively, I say, okay, where do I need to sacrifice, give myself over to her for her benefit?
Absolutely.
Right? To see her furthered. Does that make me happy that I have to do that? No. The sense that now I gotta reorient everything that I'm thinking of, okay, in order to minister to her. But that's where true love comes in. That's what love is. Love is giving yourself over to the other person for their benefit without any expectation in return. Right?
Love is the answer. I always think love is the answer.
Sure. Love is huge. Love is huge. Now, again, you have to ask yourself, where does love come from and why is it so valuable from an evolutionary standpoint? I don't think most people truly understand what love entails because they watch so many romantic comedies. They think it's about a feeling and about being happy.
I agree completely with
that. Right. So if you get married with the goal being happiness, you're going to be disappointed week two. I mean, it's just the way it is.
What's the goal then? I thought the goal was to find someone you love and create a happy life.
Well, yeah. Well, how do you define love? Love is happiness?
I wouldn't say that. I would say, I don't know. I don't know how I define love. Love can sometimes be uncontrollable. Like, I loved my dog before he died so much, I would have traded places with him, you know?
Yep. There's that emotional side to love, but sometimes emotions can cloud you in the other direction.
Agree.
Love does bring emotion with it, but emotion can't be the driving force. If you marry somebody because of this intense emotion, you know what happens with emotion. It clouds your judgment, right?
As a magician, I can tell you, I abuse that fact all the time.
Exactly. You're playing on people's emotions, right? Now, you're getting them to be emotionally invested in your act. But that doesn't mean that you love them that way, right? And when the magic is over, the emotion goes away. And now they're looking for something else. So if you make that emotional feeling the thing that you're going to chase after, emotions are only going to get you so far. At some point in time, they're going to peter out. So love is the driving factor in the sense that you I think you hit the nail on the head earlier when you talked about sacrifice. Love is giving yourself over, sacrificing yourself for the other person for their benefit. Now, if you have a good marriage, your partner is going to be sacrificing themselves, in our case, herself, for my benefit. So now it becomes she's helping me to become the man and the husband I need to be, and I'm helping her to become the wife and the mom that she needs to be.
So let's capture that exact moment that you just said, Anthony, because people go to therapy for years and don't get the essence of what you just described.
I struggle greatly with anxiety and depression and massive ADHD. And so I struggle greatly to find happiness. And sometimes I have no explanation why. I just feel absolutely in a funk and I'm caught up in my own brain and I can't get out of it. I mean, what about people that struggle mentally that don't know why?
Right. So they're searching for something. They know they need something. They just don't know what it is that's going to satisfy them. Correct?
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. That sounds good.
Well, you're searching for something. So you're feeling like you're in a funk because somewhere along the lines, you're not satisfied either with yourself or a situation or something else that's going on in life.
Yeah, I could see that. My brain is literally getting less dopamine and serotonin than other people. I was born that way. My neurotransmitters don't transmit it as much as other people.
But you recognize that there's something different about you than other people. Now, on my worldview, I would say that you're a human being created in the image of God. You're going to have certain talents, gifts, and abilities, and certain other things that are going to hinder you. And I think that's the effect of sin and the fall in our life. Human beings are not what they used to be, okay, because evil was brought into the world and evil affects us. Evil affects us emotionally, evil affects us physically, evil affects us even to the point of you know, wanting other people to die. You look at what's going on in the Middle East and Russia and Ukraine and all around the world. People are killing each other. And this is the exact opposite of what love is. So what I would tell you, Max, is that God created you the way you are with certain talent, gifts, and abilities. And your satisfaction is to be found in Him and Him alone. You are a human being created in the image of God with infinite worth and value, regardless of your dopamine level, regardless of your HDHD. And as you start to read the scriptures and apply them in your life, you'll recognize, oh my goodness, there's a whole world out there that I didn't even realize existed because I'm now seeing it through different eyes. You've been seeing it through your eyes. I don't know how old you are for that many years, right?
I'm 18.
Sin has definitely affected the world. So you've been seeing it for 18 plus years, right? From a certain point of view. And maybe it's just time to say, you know what? Let me hop out of my worldview for a little time, step into Anthony's worldview and start to see things through the lenses that he's looking at it through and see if it makes more sense or if it changes the way you think. Or if maybe you start praying and say, you know, Lord, I suffer with this ADHD. Do you have a purpose for it in my life? Or is this something that, you know, if I pray, you'll take away? Because sometimes in our disabilities, God is actually using that for the help of someone else so that the comfort that I receive God in my difficult circumstance, I am now able to comfort someone else who's in the same circumstance and let them know, first of all, there's hope. All right. You can live with a disability. Many people do. Maybe God has a greater purpose for it in that your ADHD may get you to stumble across on something, some business technique that you never realized existed before, right?
Absolutely.
So there could be a positive benefit to having something like that.
I think there is. I think there's always, especially with ADHD, you know, there are very positive benefits to it. Mm-hmm. There's also incredible detriments that hold me back from seeing how I come across to other people. Mm. Me thinking I'm coming across one way and then receiving information from multiple sources that I was coming across a different way, which is really, really frustrating because then it makes me question my intuition.
Right. But it's also a perception too. And we can't possibly be everything to everybody.
No,
not at all. I just mean in terms of either offending someone or interrupting too much. I'm naturally an incredibly curious person, like you, Anthony, like you, Jack. We are three very curious people, right? Mm-hmm. And I can often come across as either manic or depressive. Mm. And in my mind, I didn't think I was coming across that way at all. Mm. And so I find it very hard for me to even function, let alone question, let alone answer these questions, because I want nothing more than to be of service to other people. I know, Anthony, I know that my favorite feeling in the world is giving somebody a gift they open and they are going to use and are excited about, because I'm not just giving them something, but having someone go, "Wow, thank you so much." Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of selfishness in there, right? In the feeling of, that's a great feeling for me. Mm-hmm. But the same thing I can do in my magic show when I can make a bunch of people laugh and cry and go, wow, I had no idea I was going to have as much fun as the kids did in this show. And afterwards come up to me and go, you surprised the hell out of me. I cannot believe how much fun that was. That feeling to me is much more satisfying than anything I do on stage, any laughs that I'm getting.
Yes.
The idea that I've given something to someone, put it outside of myself.
And brother, can I suggest that that's part of the image of God in you? Like God created you and gave you talents, gifts, and abilities. And when you employ those talents, gifts, and abilities, God gets this incredible pleasure because he says, look what my creation is doing. He's using the gifts that I gave him to benefit someone else. That's what I do. right? So that's part of the image of God in you. And you just said it with your own mouth. That's when you're most satisfied, right? So that's the difference between selfishness, what pleases me and makes me happy, versus selflessness and sacrifice.
Yes,
what am I going to do to love my neighbor as myself? Put a smile on their face. Sow into them, you know, brighten their day somehow, some way, point them somehow to the creator that made them, and tell them about the infinite worth and value they have as a human being.
I love that. And that ties back right into you saying you help people, you don't sell them stuff, right?
Yeah. Wow. That's a good circle back. Yeah.
But it's the truth.
It
is. When you're not trying to, I mean, I don't know about you. I'm sure maybe you've read books like I have on great salesmen and people that were incredible sellers. None of them were hard sells. It was all about a relationship. It's always about, what can I do for you? How can I help you? How can I make your life better? And if none of this lines up, then that's fine. But I'm going to do my best to help you.
Right.
You came here looking for insurance or looking for a car. I would love to help you solve your problem.
Yes. Now, here's one of the pitfalls, because you can start doing this, and because you're genuine and you really are building relationships, you start to get successful. And what happens is money starts rolling in, right? And now the scripture will tell you, the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, right? Jesus says you cannot serve both God and mammon. Mammon is looking for you to serve it. So all of a sudden, this thing that was just coming to you because you were being nice to other people and building relationship, now you start getting this money. Now the money wants you to serve it. It wants to take control over you. And then all of a sudden, your focus starts to shift. Hey, wait a second. This is earning me lots of money. And with money, I can do this, and I can do this, and I can do this, and I can do this. And it distracts you, and it takes you away from what made you successful in the first place. And now you start lying, cheating, and stealing to get the money to do the things that you want to do that make you happy, not the things that satisfy you in helping the other client. So the love of money can turn into a really dangerous thing. It can become an idol to you. I mean, do you realize?
And this is why casinos are in business.
Yes. This is why so many people are selling themselves to get money. I mean, they think that money is what's going to make them happy. I can read to you, if you want, a story about eight guys. I mean, it'll take 2 minutes. About eight guys, some of the most successful guys in the world, that all ended up in a bad way because they put money first. Do you realize this? And this might surprise you.
To you for hours. This is so good.
I'm glad.
And what we're going to do, and I don't mean to cut you off, sure, Anthony, but what we are going to do is we're going to invite you to a follow-up podcast so that we can explore, because there's so much relevancy to everything that you're talking about.
I'm thoroughly enjoying this, by the way. I really appreciate it.
And now I want to hear the story about the eight guys, but maybe that has to wait till next time. I don't know, Jack.
Maybe that's the cliffhanger.
I don't know.
You want to do the cliffhanger? I'm good with that.
Okay, let's do the cliffhanger. Okay. And this has been phenomenal. I'm so grateful to you being here, Anthony. And I do want to extend this to another podcast, maybe even a series of them.
Okay.
But please, your finishing comments or thoughts about everything that we've been talking about today.
So one of the things that people really don't realize about the scriptures talk about love, the scriptures talk about faith, the scriptures talk about sacrifice. Do you know what topic the scriptures address more than love, sacrifice, and faith combined? Money.
Money.
There's over 2,500 verses in the Bible, Old and New Testament, concerning money. Because money is a gateway idol. You start getting money, and now you can dive into prostitution. You can dive into gambling. You can dive into drug use. You can dive into all these things. And money is what allows you to get those things. All right. That's why most people think the Bible says money is the root of all evil. That's not what the Bible says. The love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. What?
I said, damn, I love money. This is terrible.
Max, it's time to break up with your money.
I'm just trying to live a better life, Anthony.
You can. Listen, if you serve others and that's what gives you satisfaction, that's what's going to fuel you. But if you serve mammon, mammon wants to take hold of you and tell you where to spend it.
Is mammon money?
Yeah, mammon is this like the spirit behind money. That particular thing, right?
Gotcha.
So I learned quickly that I need to tell my money what to do, right? Money talks to you. Pull out any bill from your wallet, and there's going to be a picture of a little man on there. And he's going to be telling you, ooh, spend me on this. Spend me on that. Spend me here. Spend me there.
Well, I'm George Washington. You know you want to spend me at the strip club. Let's go.
Now it's more like Benjamin Franklin, but that's a different story, right?
Right.
So when I tell my money what to do and I appropriate it where it needs to be appropriated, now I'm in control. So I make it a point to give a certain percentage of my money away because I'm not going to be dependent on it. Money's dependent on me to bring it in. And then I tell it where to go and what to do. Because so many people get wrapped up in the love of money. And now it becomes they're willing to lie, cheat, and steal, even murder to get money. Look at what I think the ratio was like
25%. Wall Street was invented.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the percentage is, but it's got to be 25% or more. People get murdered for what? Money.
Money.
To
money.
Steal the wallet or to get their fortune or to take out the life insurance and then kill the husband or the wife to collect the what? The money.
Yeah.
And most of these people, and this motive. Will get to the cliffhanger next time. What happens when people get a lot of money? Does it make them happier? No,
never.
It doesn't.
They have
it
the same problems we do.
It's amazing. But
it's never enough, right? It's never enough.
For that reason.
It really is. In good hands, somebody that has a moral code and understands where that comes from, money is a tool and it can be used in an extraordinarily positive way.
Mm-hmm.
But it does come from having a foundation and a belief and knowing the difference between good and bad.
Money in and of itself is not evil. The person behind it, the love of it, we are the ones who are directing the money. Having money is a tremendous tool and you can do tremendous good with it. Like you said, with the right moral code, I direct my money where it goes, but it's trying to take you over. Look at what our country looks like.
It's the most divided it's ever been.
So many people pursuing stuff. And I'm not saying don't do your best to earn the best living you can to provide for your family and be charitable and that kind of things. There's plenty of people in the Bible who were rich and did great things with it. There were other people who sold their souls for it.
Get yourself right.
Yes.
First.
Yes.
Giving back is one of the biggest keys, I think, to living a fulfilling life.
Absolutely, Max. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
Anthony, I know that I speak for Max. This has been a phenomenal discussion with you. I am thrilled that you joined us today and we're going to do this again.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to thank you personally. I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in and we hope that you've had some aha moments in yourself. And if you haven't already subscribed to our list, please do. And you will be notified once we have Anthony back on the next podcast.
Thank you guys for having me. This was a real treat.
Anthony, it's so nice to meet you. Thank you for coming.
Likewise, Max. Likewise.
Till next time.
Yes. Till we meet again.
Till we meet again. Wow. That was so fascinating. And what a wonderful conversation that was. Actually, you told me he's one of your oldest friends. He's a lovely guy. And he's very smart and lived up to my full expectations. What a lovely human being. I can't wait to talk to him again.
Yeah, man. I agree with you. And I loved the vulnerability that you displayed and because these are questions that we all grapple with. And you're not alone, Max. Some of us, we suffer silently and we don't talk about it. These are really important questions. And I love where he gets his source of truth from. It's very clear where his source of truth comes from. And it's fascinating, man. I'm glad that he was here today.
Yeah. What'd you learn? Did you learn anything today?
Yeah, of course. I was married at the time, probably about 13 years. And I made a decision to move on in my life. And I'm always reminded of the fact that I had made a commitment when we decided to get married, you know, thick and thin. This was a long-term commitment.
Catholic wedding?
And I No, it wasn't. It was not a Catholic wedding. It was done in front of a clergyman. But we still had a bond and a commitment that we made to one another in the same ways that most people will say each other's vows. And I struggled with the fact because at the time I felt as if I wasn't getting what I needed to make me happy and to make me whole. And over a course of almost 13, 14 years, I decided that this just wasn't right for me. And I felt like I wasn't giving her what she needed. And so as I started to really process this and had some conversations with Anthony later on down the road, and he brings up this notion of stepping into your partner when they need it most. And if you both do that collectively together, then you do have a beautiful foundation of a life together. And it's not about, well, I don't like the way she responded to me. I don't like the way she didn't respond to me based on something. Maybe I reached out and tried to have a hug with her and she pulled back. Well, I take that personally. And I say, okay, well, why did that happen? When in fact, there's something going on maybe within her or maybe even between the two of us that I haven't yet uncovered.
Maybe it's not that personal. Yeah.
Yeah. It could be a lot of things. I know that the most important things on this planet is love and relationships. Where that divinity comes from is what we're talking about today. I don't think I could articulate it as clearly and as eloquently as Anthony can, but I believe that those two fundamental things is the essence of life and what makes us happy.
He really got me thinking about the Big Bang and about the creation of the universe, like very technically, because it's not something I think about. But I feel like I think the universe has always been here. It is the great creator and sustainer of life. There's so many things we still don't know about the universe involving black holes and collapsing stars. And I'm making things up now just because I really would love to know as much as Neil deGrasse Tyson. But I feel like it's always been here, and we are a beautiful, shining example of what the universe is capable of. I still don't necessarily know if I believe that someone made us. But if that's the same thing as the universe making us, then maybe I do believe in God. You know,
I don't like not knowing, quite frankly. I think even with all the evidence from a scientific perspective or all the evidence from a biblical perspective, we are creatures in such a way where we, unless we can taste it, unless we can feel it, touch it, we have a hard time reconciling what is real and what isn't real. And I think that's where if you follow God as the ultimate source of everything in life, then you have faith in that, and that faith becomes your guiding compass. Whereas from a scientific perspective, it's, you know, chemicals. It's everything outside of faith. It's just the facts around how we came into existence.
I personally have no problem with it just being chemicals. That's my working opinion, is that I have no problem with that we have developed as a species to be loving and nurturing in the same way many animals have, but not to our extent, you know? Animals that have, of species that have taken in other animals of other species and taken care of them and fed them, you know?
Yeah, to your point, I've grappled with both sides of it as well. And the one thing that I concluded in my mind is that I don't know that I'm ever going to be satisfied with answers that are provided to us by other humans. But the one thing is that I want to be prepared in my life for significant heartache that is going to come our way. And whether it be the loss of our loved ones, it could be something beyond that. It could be, you know, global warfare. That if I don't have a strong foundation of faith, then I'm probably just going to take myself out to the back of the barn. And what if I'm wrong? What did I lose? What did I lose by believing in faith and having faith that there is something greater than us? I haven't lost anything. And then what is the quality of my life on earth if I realize that, you know, the world that we live in and is far greater than my own viewpoints and the way that I think about things. I don't know. I think that it's far, in my view, and for me at least, I think it's better to have faith and to believe in everlasting life, especially when the chips are down and I start losing, you know, my family, my loved ones, the closest people to me.
Yeah, people start to believe in God when they're in the foxhole, right?
Yeah, yeah. Better to believe prior to those events happening, because now you have a foundation of how you're going to put it all into proper perspective.
Do you think you're believing out of fear of what might happen if you don't?
No.
No. Okay.
No. 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 No, because the idea of somebody passing on, and as I get older and my parents get older and the people in my life get older, I know that, you know, there's two things in life that are guaranteed. And one of them is death and the other one is taxes.
Right.
And we know that. And in my mind, I say, okay, well, you're prepared for what you're going to go through when somebody that you care for passes on. And it doesn't have to be parents. It could be very dear friends. It could be spouses, you know, it could be siblings. And I'm not putting this into the universe, but life is delicate and anything could happen. And I just wonder when that does occur, how I will handle it.
You will find consolation in the Lord. And that's great. Like I told you, I'm jealous. I've thought of it many times. I'm jealous of people that have an extra level of everything's going to be okay when I die, because it puts you at ease. And I'm excited to live as much as I can live, so that when by the time I die, I will have helped enough people, hopefully, that they worship me as a god. No, that they. That I've given more than I've received. Does that make sense?
Yeah. 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 Yeah, for sure. For sure. And that puts you in service. And that's what Anthony was referring to earlier.
It's the best feeling.
And it is a good feeling. It is a really good feeling. I'm very interested in having Anthony come back again and talking things through, because a lot of people, including me, I've struggled with my purpose in life. I think there's two different sets of people, and me being one of them, is that we're in total alignment with what we do and how we serve others. And then for others in another camp, we're not in full alignment with what we do. We use it as a means to an end. But then if we're not doing something, and that's okay, actually, that's perfectly okay. It takes the pressure off of people finding their calling, quote unquote. But as long as there's something that's filling the cup beyond the job and the vocation, then that's a good place to be. It's when you don't have something that's filling your cup.
Jack,
and many people don't know what that is.
For absolutely. People are searching. What if we don't have a calling, Jack?
And that's okay.
What if theoretically we don't have a calling, that we choose what we want to do in this life, that we are able to design this life to our liking, especially nowadays with the amount of technology we have.
Yeah, agreed. And many of us do that. We do design the lives that we want, and hopefully it's coming from a place of a place that feels congruent with who you are as a person, because if that's the case, nothing is going to be handed to you on a silver platter. We both know how difficult it is to pursue new things in our lives and ventures, and everything is a bit of a challenge. Relationships are a challenge. Managing money, being fiscally responsible, getting healthy, physically active, eating right, making sure our health is on point, on and on and on. There's so many different facets to this. And I think that it can be overwhelming for all of us, which is why I like the idea of breaking life into bite-sized chunks of what I think is most relevant to us. There are subsets to each of them, but I think in general, all of us want to have great relationships. We want to be accepted and we want to be respected by our peers and by our loved ones.
We need human connection.
Human connection is so incredibly important. Absolutely. But if our health is failing us and if we're struggling with disease, it's hard because it puts our mental framework in a different light. And it's not impossible, but we have to take care of ourselves from a health perspective so that we're not obsessing and we're not letting our lives degrade in such a way where we cannot show up as our best selves when we're with other people. And then, of course, Anthony was talking about obviously spirituality and what that means to each of us. And maybe if it's not religious based, it's spiritual based. Everybody reaches their own conclusions. That's the beautiful part about being human and alive today. I just think that it's important to know that it's not about our own universe and what we think about in our lives. We have not arrived, and we only know a fraction of what we possibly could know. Some of us walk around on this planet all knowing, my way or the highway. Well, it's because you don't have that connection beyond or outside of your own earthly world. The other thing, and really, and this is kind of like the four quadrants, is we talk about wealth, and Anthony talked about how money can be the root of evil. It's not money itself, it's the love of it. It's the love of money and how we worship money. Many of us worship it.
Especially when we don't have it.
Well, when we don't have it, there becomes an obsession around accumulating it, bringing more of it into our lives. And unfortunately, there's a lot of us that want to take shortcuts, and we don't want to do the work that's necessary in order to make impact and have value to people who are willing to exchange monetary rewards to you because you're providing value to them. And that takes effort and time to put together.
As a magician and somebody who has studied the greatest con artists of all time, I'll tell you, the lottery would not exist if people did not want shortcuts. Good idea. The government stole it from the mob and said, you can't do this anymore.
This has been a great podcast and a great discussion. I think we should keep the door open and continue on this journey. And,
yeah, I'll get a rabbi on here too. I'm fascinated by this. Let's do it. And there's 3,000 gods that people worship on this planet. Over 3,000 separate deities. We're just talking about one of them. Could be a lot to get into here. Also, a lot of other stuff that's not faith-based. I'm just trying to learn and grow and be the best person I can be. Because like I said, I don't know. There is so much I don't know. And I am curious.
As I am, Max. I love you, brother. As always, I think we should put a pin on it. I've got an appointment coming up in 10 minutes.
Let's put a pin in it. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, review, and rate this show wherever you get your podcasts, and we appreciate you listening. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
If you like this episode of the Jack and Max Show, please subscribe, rate us, and review us on wherever you get your podcasts from. It helps more than you can know, and it costs nothing and only takes a second. So just do it, please. But if you don't, I won't know, so you don't have to. But please do it. It really helps us.